like to call the Finance Administration Committee meeting to order. Today is Wednesday, September 27th at 9 a.m. For the record, I'd like to have everyone go around the room and just state your name so that we know who attended. I am Carmela Corsini, Trustee Finance Committee Chair.
Russ Vasquez, a trustee, member of the Finance Committee.
Eric Palm, Village Administrator.
Susan Conti, trustee, member of the committee.
Cheryl Scott, Assistant Finance Director.
Joan Rock, Finance Director.
Kimberly Marshall, Senior Manager with BKD.
Scott Termine.
Scott Termine, partner from BKD. Sorry, I don't have a light on mine.
Okay. Thank you. And we have a quorum. So with that, I'll move down the agenda. We don't have any public comment. I would just like to make one announcement that for our committee trustees that we're going to hopefully have a meeting sometime in October or November. I'm not sure date-wise, but we're working with the pension actuaries to come up with a reevaluation of our pension funding plan. It's been over 3 years since we put the plan together. We're ending our phase-in of the plan, and so we thought this would be a good time to review the policy, get together with the police and fire pensions, and revisit some of the opportunities that we have. So Joan is going to work on scheduling that, so just be on the lookout for that. And then we have two newer members. I know you were on the Finance Committee before, right?
It was a long time
yeah,
ago.
So we have a newer member to the Finance Committee, Trustee Vasquez. So generally, Finance Committee meets not very often, but we do meet now at this time of year to review the audit. And then pension funding will be another meeting. And sometimes we may or may not meet before the budget, but you know, these are the opportunities that we have to meet. So just so you know that that's going to be coming up. So with that, the next item on our agenda is the purpose for our meeting today is to review the 2017 draft of the Comprehensive Annual Financial Report. And we have our auditors here, the partner, Scott and Termine, and Kimberly Marshall, the manager, senior manager. I'm going to turn it over to Joan, our finance director, who will go through the memo that she prepared for us, and then we will have the auditors speak with us, and we can ask any questions. And
yeah,
we'll
feel free to jump
there.
In if you have any questions as we go along. I'm going to break it down as my memo is broken down. On the first page, I show the general fund revenue activity. Overall, we exceeded budgeted revenue by $819,000. Most of that, the reason for that increase, though, was building permit activity and the net change in the IRMA deposit, which are not really recurring or, you know, revenues that we can count on every year. Sales, intergovernmental and tax revenue was down $62,000 from the prior year. And they were $222,000 lower than the budgeted amount. Sales and home rule tax revenue were down the first half of the fiscal year due to lower sales from existing businesses. Possibly due to, I was thinking, competition from businesses that opened up in neighboring communities that might have been pulling some of the business from our town. They did recover during the second half of the year, so when you look at month to month, there was recovery during the second half of the fiscal year, probably due to Rally House opening in the town center. This fiscal year, obviously with Fresh Time opening, we're hoping for further recovery, so I'm hoping that that does turn around for us. The income tax revenues were down. I did go to a meeting that the Illinois Department of Revenue held. Their explanation of that was that corporate income tax revenues were down throughout the state. They attributed that to the change in the federal income tax code, which brings the taxable revenues down for the state as well. And also there's some concern that businesses are moving out of Illinois. I don't know, I don't have any document to prove that, but and they also said that they changed their accounting system And so they more exactly put these corporate tax revenues into the various pots, like the local government distributive fund, which is where the income tax comes from, and then the replacement tax pot. So we saw an increase in our replacement tax, but we saw a decrease in the income tax because of that. Gas and electric utility taxes were less than budgeted, but they did increase from the prior year. Those revenues are very weather dependent, so it depends on, you know, how hot it is in the summer and how cold it is in the winter. So those fluctuate every year based on weather. Telecommunication tax revenues came down again. I thought that they were stabilizing a little bit, but the cellular phone companies continue to attribute more and more of the cellular tax bills to data charges, and so the tax is not applied on the data charges. It's applied on the line, you know, the phone, regular phone charges. I've tried to analyze exactly what they're doing with the tax, but I don't know, but it seems like that's probably going to continue to decline. And also people are eliminating their landlines. So I don't expect that revenue to come back. I expect that revenue source to probably continue to decline. It's not going to be something that we can count on every year. License and permit revenue was up significantly. We got revenue from the Concordia Residence Hall and also the townhomes on Madison Street. So again, this is not a revenue source that we will get every year. It's something that's unusual in nature. It did help our bottom line, but it's not something going forward that we're going to have in the budget to fund our general fund. And then investment income was higher due to the increase in short-term interest rates. So that's a bulk of the information on the revenues, the areas that we need to be concerned about, and we'll talk about all of this more probably going into the budget process, but we need to really keep a close eye on our revenues. The next page shows the general fund expenditures by department. We were slightly less than the amount that was budgeted, not a lot. We were up 3.8% from the prior fiscal year. Building revenues are higher due to the increased cost of inspections and plan reviews due to the building permit activity. I think a lot, Eric probably knows more than I do, but I assume that a lot more was outsourced than normal because we had such a large volume of activity coming in this year. Fire department salaries were lower due to employee retirements, and then the new employees that come in start lower on the chart and get paid less, so it causes a reduction in salaries. And then contributions to the police and fire pension funds are higher than the prior fiscal year. The budgeted and actual contributions are the amount of the 2016 property tax levy that were included in our pension funding policy transition plan. Now, next year's budget will be at the top of that transition plan, and at that point we're supposed to be paying what the actuary recommends. And that's why this is critical that we discuss the pension funding policy at this time, because we need numbers to put into the 2019 budget. So that's why I want to do it in November and have a good idea of where we're at by December, so that when we're looking at projections and stuff, we have the numbers that we're going to be using going forward. I anticipate some plan changes, because it's going to be difficult to reach those levels, especially with fire. And then public works expenditures include higher tree, building, and street maintenance costs. On page 3, I included a chart that shows our results of operation, and I also am showing the amount of our unassigned fund balance plus the amount reserved for working cash as a percentage of subsequent years' budgeted expenditures. And we increased from 44.8 to 47.2. Our policy requires 25%. So we're above our policy amount, and we did increase from the prior year. However, again, that was not due to our recurring revenues. More so, it was due to building permit revenues. So it looks really good on paper, but we've got to look at the underlying reasons for that increase.
And also that IRMA increase is restricted, basically. So we're, that's not, so, you know what I'm saying? So
yeah,
that's something that we
that's
need
in
to,
non-spendable.
Right.
So that's not taken into account with this 47.2. It is why another reason why our overall fund balance increased,
right.
But I don't look
right.
at that when I'm
okay.
looking at our funding amount. And then on the next page, page 4, I have the results of the water and sewer fund activity. The water and sewer fund net position increased by $581,000. We experienced a 4% increase in billed consumption, which is, again, primarily weather-related. We had been seeing some decline, so that was kind of good news. We did bounce back up. This year, I think it continues to be, especially like recent dryness and heat, and more people watering their lawns, that kind of a thing. It helps that revenue source. We also had an 8.7% increase May 1st to cover the higher operating costs, and then that was our final bump up for the Northside Stormwater Management Project. We started paying down the IEPA loan this fiscal year. So when we've got that final debt schedule, it's included in the audit with all of the revenues in. And we did not get an increase from the City of Chicago.
Is it scheduled again for next year, an increase? Or
they did one June 1st of 2017.
So they did this year.
They
so
did do
was,
a small
what percentage
increase.
Was that?
It's the way they've rewritten their code is that every June 1st, they will do a CPI increase. I'm not exactly sure what time period that what you know, just ours is like for tax levies December
right.
to December. I don't know if theirs is June to June or what their time frame is, but it's based on the CPI increase.
Yeah, that was always used to be December or January.
Used to be January 1st.
So does that? I know that's we incorporate that increase into our.
We
budget.
Did this year.
Okay.
Yes, we did our increase and the Chicago increase at one time June 1st. Normally, we have ours effective May 1st. We waited until June 1st.
So for our billing purposes, I don't know if we have consistent billing dates as far as
yeah,
like billing periods.
Yeah,
that was prorated onto
yeah,
the bill. Okay.
And what was CPI? 0.67?
Well, this year.
Ours was point, for the tax levy, it was 0.7. I don't know.
Right.
I don't recall what theirs was.
I think they went up a little. I think they used, well, didn't the CPI go up for what we're using for next year's? Budgeting purposes or for it's a tax levy?
Yeah, 2.1
okay.
for
so
next
I don't know
year.
What they use, but that would be interesting to see
I don't
the
have
number
that
they
with
use.
Me, but
okay.
I can email that
on.
Out if you want. Overall, the water and sewer fund seems to be doing well. We did have them come out and reevaluate our rates. They agreed that our rates were sufficient to cover expenses, I should say. So we didn't actually present that rate study to the board. There really wasn't anything eye-opening in it. It just was kind of confirming that we're on the right path. I also want to encourage all of you who haven't already to read the transmittal letter and the management discussion and analysis, which are the two reports. It's a letter and then a report at the front of the CAFR document. They explain activity, what's gone on during the fiscal year, talk a little bit about the future, and they also explain all the changes in revenues, expenditures, and the net position. So it's a good document to look at. They explain how the report is laid out, too, so you understand all the various reports that are included in here and what they mean and what the purpose of them are. I'm going to now turn this over to BKD to go over the report itself and then the management letters.
Sure. Thanks, Joan. Thanks, everyone, for your time this morning. As I had a chance to look at Joan's memo, I thought she did a really nice job of just kind of overlaying and outlining the fund level activity. So I thought I'd talk for just a couple minutes on the overall report. And for those of you that aren't as familiar maybe with the layout of the governmental model, you ultimately have two layers of financial statements included in your report, the fund level financial statements, which everybody's more accustomed to seeing and monitoring during the year. But then with the CAFR, you get the entity-wide level, which incorporates all of the capital asset and long-term debt type activity and really starts to look more like a typical business model financial statement. So I'll touch on that level in a little bit more detail this morning. First thing I wanted to highlight for you is just our audit opinion. So the CAFR is divided up into three main sections: the introductory section, the financial section, and then the statistical section of the report. So our opinion is found in the introductory section, and that's going to be on page one of your documents. It does just come right before the management's discussion analysis to help you possibly find that a little bit easier. But just highlighting the fact that this year, as in the past, we are able to provide what we refer to as a unmodified or clean opinion on the financial statements. So ultimately, that means that we were able to satisfy ourselves that everything is properly presented in accordance with generally accepted accounting principles. So that's exactly what you want under the circumstances. The next thing then that I would call to your attention is, as you get into the actual financial section just following the MD&A, then is where those entity-wide financial statements that I referred to begin. So the first one that you see is the statement of net position, ultimately the balance sheet for the village as a whole. And here you can see that this does incorporate the capital asset activity, as I alluded to previously. So total assets get much larger at this level than they do at the financial statement level, because those capital assets are certainly the most significant asset within the village. So total assets for the village as a whole are about $64 million. We then reduce that by the liabilities of the village. And here, Joan alluded a lot in her memo to the pension funding issue. You may recall last year being the first year that you had to adopt GASB Statement 68, which brought those pension-related liabilities onto your financial statements for the first time. So that's a continued point of emphasis and struggle, frankly, for most governmental entities because of the size. And you can see they're incorporated within the non-current liabilities of approximately $55 million. You do have roughly $40 million of that coming from the pension liabilities combined between the IMRF plans, your police, and then fire pension plans. So that's something that you and all governments really will need to continue monitoring, and careful look at that funding policy is certainly a good policy to consider, and just try to look for ways to continue to make sure that the funding is there for those plan liabilities. At the entity-wide level, then, we divide up the net position, which is the remaining equity position for the village, into three categories, which is your net investment and capital assets. So we take the asset values, we reduce those by accumulated depreciation, and we also reduce that by any debt that is associated with acquiring those assets. So that's what that first figure, the net investment in capital assets, represents. And you can see there that for the village as a whole, you've got about $25 million net invested in the capital assets. We also have several lines here for restricted items, and these are items that are either restricted for use under statutory requirements, perhaps other legal arrangements, things of that nature. So those are items that you ultimately just can't spend at your own discretion. There's defined uses and limits around those items. And then the last item is the unrestricted position. So here you can see that the village does have a deficit position, and that is because of the pension liabilities. And that is a common struggle that most governmental entities got into last year as we brought on those pension-related liabilities. So almost everyone did swing into that deficit position with last year's round of financial statements. So that's certainly something to continue to be mindful of and aware of, and as the pension liability dwindles down, that will also then hopefully start to trickle back up, but it does certainly tie into the other fund level activities within the village. So within the entity-wide level, then the next statement is the statement of activities, and this then, as with the previous statement, we make a number of adjustments from the fund level financial statements up to here for some of those items that I already alluded to, capital asset related activity. You're going to start to capture depreciation type expense and other adjustments. So this is presented in a much different format than what you see in typical financial statements because of the governmental model. The ultimate goal and objective here with this layout is that you start with expenses because ultimately, unlike a normal business entity, governments are here to deliver service to the constituents. So you start off with that expense figure, and then you reduce it by any offsetting revenues. And we do that in two ways that you can see captured on this statement is we start off with what we refer to as program-related revenues, which are things that are directly attributable to those functions. And then we come to that net expense figure for each of the functional areas that you have within the village, so general government, public works, public safety, et cetera. That net expense figure then ultimately gets subsidized by the village's tax, various taxes, property taxes, intergovernmental taxes. So those are other offsets that you have going against that net expense figure to see ultimately and come down to what the overall change in net position was for the year, which is, again, broken up into two levels, governmental activities and then the business type activities, the water and sewer functions. And at that level, you don't have any other adjustments going on because you're already capturing that information at the full accrual level. So overall, the village had a decline of about $950,000 overall in the net position for the year. And that is certainly attributable to some of those governmental level activities, the pensions, the capital asset related activities, and things of that nature. So I'm going to pause there for a moment. I know a lot to take in at that level, certainly. within the financial section of the report, it's composed of your basic financial statements and then the notes to the financial statements. For this year, unlike last year with GASB 68 and the pension standard change coming in, we didn't have any real significant changes for this year. There was a new standard that came in relative to the village's investment-related disclosures. So some modifications were made there to the way that the fair value presentations appear within the footnotes. But overall, the reporting is in a similar format to what you've seen in the prior year report. So just wanted to pause there and see if there's any particular questions or items that you'd like me to drill down on for you at the financial statement level.
I mean that, you know, offhand when you just look at the net position decrease of the 1.5 million, mm-hmm. you know, it's a large number. So, but breaking it down, you have to go into the pension funding and the GASB 68 pronouncement that
sure.
really made us, everybody look bad. But
yeah.
it's the true statement of future payments that we have to make. So
right. Yes.
As much as we don't like it, we have to.
And I'm saying, as we as trustees need to be able to articulate that and get those questions so that it's, to understand why that
sure.
number is what it is.
So to help in that regard, I'd point on page 25 in the document. You have a reconciliation there that helps you go from the fund level up to the entity-wide level, and this one is capturing the statement of activities or the income statement level. So you can see on page 25 there that we start off with the fund level where you had a decrease in your governmental fund position of about $200,000. And we show all of those adjustments that I alluded to that roll into ultimately that change at the entity-wide level of $1.5 million. And you can see, as I alluded to there at the top, the capital asset activity is certainly one of the biggest components. At the fund level, you're capturing all of those outflows as expenses, mm-hmm. Whereas at the entity-wide level, we capitalize those and depreciate them. So those are adjustments that are reflected there that net off to about $1 million of impact right there. And then as you follow that down, the next largest is certainly the long-term debt-related activity towards the bottom there with the various changes in the pension liabilities and some of the deferred items that are presented there. I didn't talk a lot about those at the statement of net position level. That's something that GASB changed a couple of years ago that I feel and most of our clients have really struggled with. It really kind of just confused the model a lot to a large degree because they're items that people aren't used to seeing in typical financial statements. When you talk about deferred inflows and outflows, no one really knows what that means.
Right.
The biggest items that you have in your statements do also come from pension related items, and those are timing issues that roll into the pension expense and the way those are accounted for in the financial statements. So as you're aware, there's a lot of actuarial assumptions that go into arriving at those pension liability figures. And some of those deferred items attempt to capture some of the changes that come in as you look at assumptions versus actual results. And those things flow into the liabilities and pension expense gradually over an amortized period. So that's what some of those deferred items ultimately represent. So you can see that at the reconciliation level here, you end up with about $2 million of adjustments when you go from the fund level up to the entity-wide level as a result of those items. So certainly significant there, and that's where I say those are the largest items to think about as you go from the discussion that Joan started off with at the fund level on up to this level in the financial statements. Any other questions just in turn? I mean, you've got 150 pages of information here in front of you. There's a lot to digest here. If there's anything else I can help you with in terms of the layout, I alluded to those three basic sections of the document. Those are sort of defined by the Government Finance Officers Association. Within the financial section, which is certainly probably the most significant of the three pieces, you have the financial statements, the notes to the financial statements, and then some required supplementary information. Those are GASB required disclosures that come with the report, largely focused on, again, pension and other post-employment benefit items, as well as some budgetary presentations. And then the statistical section of the report gives you sort of, in most cases, 10-year type comparisons of some of the financial activity to give you that historical perspective and just a point of reference to see how things have changed over the years. So all of those schedules and tables are also dictated and defined by GASB standards. And again, thinking back to our opinion, everything that you've presented here has ultimately been deemed to be fairly stated in accordance with those guidelines. So no issues from our perspective. We certainly appreciate all of the assistance from Joan and the finance staff that we received. As many of you are aware, we had some team rotation. So Kim and I are new faces for you. That was part of our commitment to be able to provide some fresh perspective within the engagement, but all of Joan and Cheryl's assistance certainly helped to make for a smooth transition from our perspective, so we do appreciate that. The other document that we issue as part of our audit then is the what we'll generically refer to as a management letter. There's a required communication there under auditing standards that we have to provide to the board. And I'll let Kim talk for a moment about that then.
Thanks, Scott. Good morning. This post-audit communication letter includes a lot of required communication, and it's very similar to what's been issued in the prior year. Under audit scope and results, we really just start off disclosing that our audit was conducted in accordance with accounting standards generally accepted in the United States of America, and our audit is designed to obtain reasonable rather than absolute assurance about the financial statements. A little bit further down on the first page, under significant accounting policies, in note one of the financial statements is where you'll find all the significant accounting policies of the village. In addition, we also disclose that the only new accounting pronouncement that was implemented was GASB Statement 72, which Scott mentioned a little earlier, relating to fair value measurement. Really, this change affected the financial statement disclosures, not the actual financial statements themselves. And our opinion was not modified in respect to with respect to this implementation. On page two at the top, we do disclose certain key estimates that were considered during the audit. Similar to prior year, the first one relates to depreciation expense, and then the second relates to pension and other post-employment benefit costs and liabilities, specifically relating to the actuarial assumptions and subject to uncertainties of future events. In the middle of the page under financial statement disclosures, we really just want to draw your attention to a few particularly sensitive financial statement disclosures, really just to point out that they're included and it would be helpful to take a look at them. The first relates to long-term debt obligations of the village. And then the second relates to a common theme for today relating to post-employment and pension benefits under IMRF and the police and fire pension funds. Under audit adjustments, the main thing to point out here is there were no entries that were identified as part of the audit process. And then finally, at the bottom of this page, under other material written communications, the only other material written communication will be the management rep letter, which will be attached to this post-audit communication letter. That letter really just discloses that management provided all the information necessary for the audit. There were no material weaknesses or significant deficiencies identified during the audit, and if there were any, it would be disclosed under this section.
I think that's really important to note, no material, yeah. Internal control issues, so we're good.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, as part of the audit process, we, you know, look at controls, look at segregation of duties, and there were no, similar to prior years, there were no significant issues found.
Thank you.
So I'll just pause there for a minute. When Kim alluded to the kind of concept of reasonable but not absolute assurance on the financial mm-hmm. statements, I'd just like to highlight and make sure everyone understands the internal control-related work that we do. Under auditing standards, what we're required to do is look at your internal control structure to allow us to gain a sufficient understanding so that we can plan our audit procedures to address risks that we see potentially being there. Ultimately, we do not provide you with an opinion on the operation of the internal control structure. That would be ultimately just kind of cost prohibitive. Under the standards, as we go through our process of obtaining that understanding, that's where we ultimately can potentially identify any of those deficiencies. And that is really ultimately what allows us to be able to kind of get our arms around the village's risk profile and identify the areas where we feel we need to really focus our audit procedures. And as Kim referenced there, no deficiencies were identified there. And with those deficiencies, it's always important to keep in mind that what we're identifying and communicating to you is potential for things to go wrong. So flaws within the design potentially that could allow for misstatements to happen in the financial statements doesn't necessarily always mean that anything did go wrong. It's just there's room there for improvement or strengthening. So that's what we ultimately communicate. So just wanted to be clear that's oftentimes a confusing issue for our boards and clients to understand is just where is that responsibility and what level of detail do we get into. So hopefully that helps. But if any questions on that, certainly happy to address those.
So if I'm clear, you actually just do like a random testing of the account or the funds, and so you don't actually look at everything. It'd be too cost prohibitive to do that, and that's understandable. But you at least follow the appropriate process, I guess, for auditing purposes and didn't identify anything.
Yes,
right.
So okay. It is certainly a sample-driven process, absolutely. We're not testing 100% of transactions. We can't do that. But certainly guided all by auditing standards and no issues were identified in that process.
And one of the biggest areas of concern usually in municipal government is segregation of duties just because the staff size is so small that you have the same person doing multiple functions. So, you know, I think it's important. Those are always the areas that you focus on, and then municipalities try to do the best they can with, you know.
We've actually made some changes in that area, improvements the previous accounting supervisor position did way too many things.
Right.
And we did, I reviewed what she did and that kind of a thing, but it really wasn't enough of a check and balance. So now we've got the separate person doing payroll over the last couple of years, and then Cheryl reviews it, and then I actually transfer the money and look at it as well and check taxes and stuff. So we've got sort of three people looking at it, whereas it used to be more one,
right,
and then some looking at it, but not as much. She really reviews the payroll in detail to make sure there isn't any mistakes or anything in the way something's been entered or calculated. And then we also, prior to that, we had moved accounts payable to another position, and off the accounting supervisor, which is now the assistant position. And so that provides more opportunity for checks and balances where one person enters, another person reviews,
right,
and then ultimately it goes to the board for their approval.
Right.
So that's really helped us a lot. I think we're in a much better position now than we used to be, where we didn't have enough staff really to split things out,
right,
as well as we could have. So.
And now you have sign-off authority too. I mean, does Eric, do you ever review anything from the finance department that's sign-off related, or?
He will approve like purchases and stuff,
right,
like that.
So you,
on
you're
the purchasing
splitting those,
level,
yeah. So the same person writing the checks isn't making the deposits, isn't it? You know,
I do all
things,
the transfers,
right?
And then everything that I do is ends up in a journal entry that Cheryl reviews,
right,
and I review all of Cheryl's journal entries. So we try to make sure we've got checks and balances everywhere. And then, as I said, I feel like the finance committee is like another set of eyes sort of looking,
right,
at things to see if there's anything that looks fishy going on.
Fishy.
Fishy.
So those are, from small staff perspective, those are usually the biggest concerns. But, yeah, I know we've made some changes, which is good. So
We really needed to.
Yeah.
I'm satisfied that those all the changes made are, everything that's necessary has been made? Or
yeah, I think we've done a real good job of adding. It's added more work because you've got more people looking at the same thing, but I think it's, you know, improved our internal controls, so, and our accuracy, like of our payroll. So
it's going to really help as, you know, as years go by and transition employees. It's going to really help,
right,
I think, as well.
Right. We've got built-in checks and balances,
right,
so should be in pretty good shape. We've also got we've done some cross training too, which for that purpose, because we anticipate some people are probably going to be leaving. So we've done quite a bit of cross training. We do procedures manuals on everything. We've got somebody else that's trained on water billing. We've got a water billing procedures manual, so that if we lose that, you know,
seamless
position,
seamless,
right,
seamless.
We've got more than one person that knows how to handle things at the front desk.
Okay.
Cheryl documents all the procedures. She does a real good job of that. And her procedures, and I've got a procedures manual that I'll be making sure is up to date prior to my.
No.
But that's true. It's always key because we do have such a small staff that, you know, you could have people that just become ill or for some
mm-hmm.
reason can't
all
show up for work, and then,
building,
you know, someone doesn't know how to do utility billing or someone
yeah.
doesn't, you know, you,
mm-hmm.
only have, you
yeah.
can't really put your eggs in one basket
right.
with
and
only one that's really knowing
to,
how to do it.
Right. Cheryl also knows how to do payroll, so that's
right.
pretty critical, and accounts payable. So if something were to happen in either of those positions, we have backup for that. So
yeah, so that's awesome.
And we try to have everything documented so that obviously if you don't do something every day, even though you've been trained on it, you're not going to remember how to do it. So we try to have written procedures with screen prints so that they can look at that and use that as a guide to completing a task. So
good job.
So from a best practice perspective, to your point, those transition periods are really the key for you as a finance committee to be able to keep a handle on what's happening and really be able to think about. That's where we refer to what we allude to as a fraud risk assessment, to make sure that you've got all those procedures updated and in place when those issues do occur and transition happens, that you kind of revisit some of those key risk areas when you talk about payroll processing, disbursement processing, relook at the controls and where there's opportunities for things to go wrong, and just kind of think through and make sure you've got all those, what we refer to as compensating or mitigating controls in place, recognizing that you do only have so many people, but some of those checks and balances that Joan alluded to really need to be in place to help mitigate those risks. So that's certainly key to keep in mind as you go forward.
And can I ask a question? When you actually look at procedures, et cetera, do you actually look at the like our policies as well?
Yes.
Okay.
Yep.
Okay.
So we review those again, looking at kind of how, if it's a control related item, looking at how that's designed, making sure that there's not opportunity for misstatements to creep in there and be able to address those if need be.
Okay.
We do an internal control questionnaire. They provide us with an internal control questionnaire. We also document in summary our procedures. So it's pretty comprehensive, a lot of questions.
Yep.
I know they looked at IT this year too, which they don't normally look at in that much detail.
Oh.
But they actually looked at some of our IT procedures and stuff.
Yeah, and that's kind of twofold to Joan's point is, I mean, certainly ultimately with the change that we had within the team, we needed to get into a little bit more depth in certain areas just to get our own familiarity. But then also we do try to incorporate from year to year elements of unpredictability into the testing so that, as Joan kind of alluded to there, we don't come in and she knows exactly what we're going to do year after year. So there is that element that we try to incorporate into the audit process as well.
Well, speaking of IT, what about the security level?
Yeah.
Is that looked at as well?
It is, and that's a great point because that's a huge risk area for all. And it's not governmental. It's across the board. It's really just become a matter of when rather than if. So that's something definitely to keep in mind. We're seeing more and more big issues creeping in, whether it's a ransomware type attack or what we refer to as business email compromises, where you get an email that looks like it's coming from a vendor that you know perhaps. We've seen the largest one at the governmental level that we've seen recently has been upwards of $500,000, where it came in as an email that looked like an ongoing public works contract scenario. They were requesting updated banking information. It was provided and the disbursement went out unauthorized. So it's a huge issue of concern and something that boards need to continue to remain focused on. We have the advantage within our firm. Our firm-wide cyber security director is actually housed in our office, so it's a great resource for us. We can certainly make him available to you as you potentially start to look at new areas and different steps that you can take. A lot of entities are starting to do more formal risk assessments to look at some of those types of issues, doing even some penetration tests, and even sort of those dummy emails that I alluded to, where we can send those out, make it look like, and see who actually does go for it and kind of build some education around that. So certainly available for you in that regard if need be. But absolutely work with your existing IT staff and be mindful of that as you go forward.
Okay. Can I ask a question? Right now we're talking about just generic and overall policies. If there was anything specific that our auditors would find, would we be going into a closed session to talk about those specifics? And I'm concerned, like, if there's any cyber threats or issues, we don't want to identify what our issues are in public, do we? If we need to address them for any potential threats?
I'd have to check with the attorney on that. I mean, there are some. I know they've made some changes to the Open Meetings Act as it relates to certain things. Like, for example, I know items related to like our water plant plans and things behind the scenes that we can risks to that, for example, there's some exemptions for that, so I'd have to look into that a little bit more. But we have been, I think as the board knows, just to dovetail on what the auditor said, we've spent a considerable amount of time, energy, and money in the last 2 to 3 years going back and making significant upgrades to our IT network and really in talking about the backbone of the network, right? So a lot of the upgrades we've made there, a lot of security enhancements, and so we're finally getting to the point over that, you know, the recommendations that our new IT vendor recommended, we've now implemented those. I think what Scott's talking about in terms of maybe having someone come in and try to test that from the outside is a good suggestion. I think something we can look at here in the coming months, because it's ongoing. That's something that's just never going
to
end.
No, and I'm not trying to discourage that. I just didn't know if we know of any particular security risk in our systems, we don't want to start announcing them in public, I would think.
Right. Yeah.
And I think if it involves personnel, obviously that's something we go into closed session.
That's exactly.
Yeah, and if there were written communications around something like that, you do have some ability for security-related issues to have some of that pulled back. So.
Okay.
And then just before we go on with that, just going back to the financial statements, I always think that it's very instructive to go back and actually read the notes of the financial statements because you glean an entirely different picture of what's going on because they're very detailed. So, you know, with regard to any of the funds or policies, you know, those are really instructive. And then going back to what Joan had said, we've taken considerable amount of time and effort into reviewing financial policies and procedures over the years and updating those, and we review those annually when she goes over the budget to see if there's anything we need to change or update. So, you know, we've stayed on top of that, which is always good to be proactive in that regard. So,
very good. Thank you.
And to your point, so Kim's going to talk now about some changes, those footnotes. It's great that you find those helpful. They just continue to grow. We talked this year, the investment disclosures have changed, so we just keep adding to it. Some of the new changes that Kim's going to get into here, we'll continue to build on those. So,
starting on page 3 in other matters, it starts off with the future pronouncement section. I was really just going to touch on the first one, GASB statement number 75.
It's at the end. It's like at after the
very
end of the packet.
Yeah.
Okay.
Let me give you mine.
I was wondering because I was flishing through it. I'm like,
it's
okay. This is the last
thing.
You've
got that's other on. Information in there too. Yeah, that's some of the stuff we talked about.
This
is the.
Okay, great. Thank you.
So under other matters, for future pronouncements, the first one is GASB statement number 75, accounting and financial reporting for post-employment benefits other than pension. So this really will change OPEB and change the liability that's recorded on the face, as well as include some extensive disclosures. This is effective for fiscal year 19 for the village.
Now, so is this something we can implement early or not? I know there's some. She's looking at me like, I don't want to do this before I go. But I'm just saying there's some pronouncements that encourage early implementation, right?
We probably won't implement early.
Frankly, this one, like the pension related one, because of kind of the actuarial tie-in and the amount of work, very few entities did choose to early adopt. You can get feel on this one, if you look within the existing document, flipping to the notes, this is similar to the way the pension standard came about. So if you look in the footnotes to the financial statements, page 53 of the notes, note 12, does include some disclosure, and again, conceptually, this is similar to the pensions, where the number was kind of there but buried in the report, and this standard is going to force it to come into the financial statements. So you can get a feel there for what the what we refer to as the actuarial accrued liability is. You can see there about $4.7 million. Similar to the pension standards, this isn't exactly what the number is going to look like. There are some actuarial changes that happen when you adopt this standard that will make the number fluctuate a bit, but it does give you a pretty good sense of what that liability will look like. So that's going to hit the financial statements just like your pension liability.
And that's retiree health care.
And so my question was, Susan, so these pronouncements come out and they give you a certain date as to when you have to implement these.
Right.
Sometimes they encourage early implementation, so you would actually do it the fiscal year prior implement those before they're mandated to be implemented. Sometimes they're just too big to take on. So you just kind
plus
of.
Plus, it involves an actuary,
right.
So we've got an actuary that does a report for us already. And they've got to be up to speed on what they're doing, and sometimes it helps to not be ahead of some of this stuff. It's easier to see some other people struggle through it first.
And OPEB, other pension, other than pension employee benefits?
Other post-employment benefits.
Post-employment.
And it's retiree health care. And then Eric, you want to talk about what you've done over the years to try to reduce this liability?
OPEB's a little funky, at least from the non-accounting standpoint, because even if you don't have any, in the layman's sense, post-employment benefits, there's still a liability, because by law, if you have, 20 years of experience or 20 years of service in IMRF when you retire or in the pension fund, you're still eligible to stay on the employer's health insurance. Even though they're paying 100%, the employee or retirees are paying 100% of that cost, there's still an OPEB value to that on our books, which...
Because they get it at a lower rate than
right.
what a person of that age would normally pay, they get it at the so that's they figure there's a cost associated with that, and we have to record a liability.
Right. So I find rules like that annoying, but I don't really get a vote. But the significant comment is that the village was paying out and subsidizing retiree health care. Then on top of that, so previously in our union contracts. The village paid for a third of the insurance premium for retirees once they hit, let's say, 20 years or so, so many years of service and as of age. So we've negotiated those benefits out of the contracts through a lot of blood, sweat, and tears. So right now, they're in the fire department. There's no one else on the staff that would get that benefit, and on the police department, the only people that are left would be, I think, the chief, the deputy, and the commander, because they're grandfathered in. But I think everyone else, is.
Yeah, it was 2013.
Or maybe one other patrol officer. I'd have to go back and look. The point being is we've made significant changes to take that stuff off so that our OPEB, as Joan has seen over time, our OPEB numbers coming down.
That's hugely significant. That something people don't really realize and understand is just the cost of future benefits. When these things were negotiated in, it was like, yeah, it's a benefit. Nobody really thinks about the long-term cost to the taxpayer, but those were huge numbers for us, and that was a hugely significant accomplishment that the staff was able to, get those bargaining
agreements
items out of that. We have to eat the cost of the grandfathering, but... moving forward, it's a big savings.
It's a helper.
Eventually,
we'll get there.
Yeah.
Yep.
So that's fiscal year 19 that you'll see this one hit for the first time.
Okay.
Joan will be on a beach somewhere, laughing all the way.
You can just send us an email. Well, how does it go?
All right. So that was 75, right?
Yeah, so I was just going to, that's probably the more significant one. Flipping ahead to page 5, after the new pronouncements, we do get into a few others that we just point out matters of interest, one related to IRS activity.
Mm-hmm.
And then the second one, Scott already actually touched on, relating to vendor fraud and business email compromise. This just goes into a little bit more detail about what that is, what we've seen. And then on the last page or the last paragraph of that section, it does talk about... that not all internal controls can prevent this. Not even spam filters or antivirus may be able to prevent it. There is a human element as part of this. So the recommendation relates to just what Scott mentioned earlier, training potentially. And if practical, to look at verification of bank wires and ACH payments and have two people involved in that process.
The ransomware issue is huge. I just had a client this week that was impacted by that. What you have there is ultimately that really highlights the need for good backup because if you do get hit and you don't want to pay, which most try to avoid, you need to have that backup to be able to get those files and recover what gets locked down there. So that's one to continue to be mindful of.
Does IRMA do any kind of training with that as far as the public liability insurance side?
They do. They have stepped up their game in recent years to, as it relates to the insuring of that. They have separate writers for cyber-related matters. But
But that's one of the things we've been spending a lot of time on recently is the backup components. So right. we have a backup, and then we have a backup to the backup type of situation. So,
I mean, I think that's a great suggestion. Right. Anytime you can get training from all different levels or areas would be good for staff. So something we can talk about with our budget process, I guess, too.
Yeah, I just heard about somebody at the conference that had to pay those bitcoins or whatever.
Yeah.
It was a government. Somebody opened up something and did something that they shouldn't have, and any file that that person had touched was impacted and locked on the entire system. So they actually just paid the money because that was like the cheapest solution. But
that's more because that makes them successful and encourages them to continue.
Yep.
Okay, so that
I just had a few comments I wanted to make before we close. On that pension funding study meeting, it's going to be probably a couple of meetings. It has to be coordinated with both pension boards. I'm on both pension boards. So it's a lot of people that we have to get together to have these meetings. And so I'm going to probably throw out some dates, try to get something from Lauterbach and Amon on what dates will work, times, some windows, and then try to throw those out to you to see what works for you out of those dates. It's a kind of a process to coordinate it. So once we set those dates, they're pretty much set. And we really like everybody to be there. I think we were successful.
Yes.
Last time we went through this, getting everybody available to attend these meetings. But it's a couple of meetings. The first one is probably longer than the second. And I have asked him to go through sort of why are we here? How did, you know, we're not exactly where we expected to be, especially on the fire side, and why has that happened? What are the, from my perspective, we've had some positive changes. We eliminated one pensionable position in the fire pension fund. We had two.
Well, the fire marshal and then the deputy fire chief.
Right.
Oh, we had two.
Two six-figure.
Right.
Positions.
So, and then we had a very young retiree that passed away without having a spouse. So, those are things that should have positively impacted the fire pension fund, and we still have not seen that in terms of the numbers. But police is pretty much on track, I would say, to where they were supposed to be. Fire, not so much. So I just wanted to let you know that's the kind of email I'll be sending out. It'll give some dates, and we're going to, you know, anything that's possible in those dates, and then I'll try to see what responses I get back from everybody and come up with the best dates, times for those meetings. I'm anticipating it won't be till probably November, because October, I'm sure they'll be very busy still working on putting together numbers for clients for their reports and getting their actuarial reports finalized. And then there will be one other meeting that we need to have and to go over the tax levy, the 2017 tax levy. It's a reassessment year. I really haven't started looking at it yet, but I'm going to try to do my best at coming up with what I expect the new property be. It's hard for me to pinpoint that with the way the county does things, but they are pulling a lot of those for the construction that's gone on. If anybody had a home improvement exemption, they let them sit. They don't, like, 3 years later or 4 years later, they don't throw them in. They don't get thrown in until the reassessment year. So they'll be commingled in with, you know, the reassessment and all. A lot of more new property will be coming in. So I want to make sure that our levy is high enough to cover anything that I feel needs to be covered. I don't know at this time whether or not it's going to be over 5%. I don't have the number yet, but, you know, it's a possibility that we may have to have a hearing. I don't know. I don't want us to leave anything on the table.
Can you get information from the code or building department?
I do.
Okay.
So I do, and I actually have, from my communications with the county, I've tried to put together some spreadsheets that, although their estimates of, like, they think a two-story addition in River Forest is worth less than $75,000. So there's some things that don't really make any sense with what they're doing. Because if somebody applies for a home improvement exemption, nothing ends up coming in, which is ridiculous. If somebody's at a second story to their home, we should see something, but we don't. So they do things kind of goofy, but I've got numbers and everything. I've got spreadsheets I put together trying to make sense out of what should be happening and what's happening, and I've found a contact at the county assessor's office that I work with in going through the new property that they're picking up. I can't do their job, so.
No, but can Pam help, our local township assessor?
Not really. Okay. She can tell me whether, like if something wasn't submitted or something, you know. But she really just takes stuff from us and then gives it to them.
She's the middleman.
She's really just the middleman.
Well, I thought she could pull down a lot of reports, though, if you need them.
She,
go ahead, I'm sorry.
No, she gives them the information.
Okay.
And then they do with it what they want. She doesn't determine what our new property is.
No, I know, I understand.
Yeah, so she just gets our permit, like our permit information. She collects that and she gives it to them. They actually say, they come out and they actually drive out and they look at and make a determination on new property and what it's worth.
Basically, we're in our reassessment, and what they do is just run a blanket program over the whole town and say, the market, you know, market values increased across the board 12%, or, you know, they throw out a percent. There is no scientific method to their madness.
They claim they did come out and look at improvements.
Yeah, well.
So I don't know if they actually do or not, but that's what they told me.
Okay.
So I'm going to...
I was just there yesterday.
I'm going to play along.
Monday.
Anyway, so I do anticipate having to have a meeting for that, and I was hoping that if... We can or cannot ask Todd to come out and actually go over the actuarial reports. We normally do have him come out, but since we're having these other meetings, I don't know if we need to have a meeting on that. I'll see what his thoughts are on that, because we're going to go through all of this in detail coming up anyway. So if you feel strongly that you want to go over the actuarial reports, it doesn't impact our contribution at this point in time because we're still on the transition plan and that's what we're going to levy. So I think we can really just wait on that until we go through this whole pension funding
study. Yeah, I mean, the numbers for 2017 are what they are.
They're not going to change, and we're going to be discussing it anyway, so
right.
I don't know that we need to.
Okay, so we need to do that in November because you have to make the announcement of the levy,
and
we're going to
prove
it earlier.
Probably early,
right,
early November or late October.
And that should not
like
be long. That won't be a very long meeting for the Finance Committee.
No,
right.
No. But I just want to run it all by
you.
The dynamic between the village and the leadership of the fire and police, are we all on the same page?
Yes. I think that relationship has improved greatly.
I
don't know if you know in the past we used to each have our own actuaries,
right,
and then we would use the village's numbers.
Actuaries.
Yeah, the dueling actuaries, that's what I like to call it. And they would literally duel. Fight. I think you were on the finance committee for that fund. There were arguments, screaming,
really
reporters
fun.
Would show up, things ended up in the paper.
Yeah.
It was really ugly. We've come a long way from those days.
Okay.
But yeah,
there are no dueling actuaries.
No, we've agreed on all the assumptions that are being used in our actuarial report.
Okay.
That's what we do as part of this meeting.
Right.
And we agree on the amount that we're going to contribute. So.
And I think that's why that coming of the minds 3 or 4 years ago was so essential, because I think we all sat in the same room, we all discussed the same, you know, our objective is the same. Obviously, we want to fund the pension funds and make sure that, you know, people that are earning those benefits are going to get their benefits when they need to get them. And at the same time, those pension funds need to understand that, you know, we have fiduciary responsibilities to the taxpayers to make sure that we're doing doing what we can.
And there's a limited pot of money. I mean, we don't have unlimited revenue. So,
but I think
that's the question they never answered, was where they wanted to get the money that they were demanding for their pension fund.
That's our suggestion.
But I think to Joan's point, you know, getting everybody together at the same time in the same room discussing objectives built a lot of
goodwill.
Goodwill.
And I think they understand now.
That's where we are now.
That the board does care about funding the pensions. I think that they thought that we were just trying to not give them any money, and I think they understand now that that is a priority. And we're trying to work together to do the best we can. Now, we can't do everything, but we're really trying to put together a good plan for funding the pensions.
And the important thing, too, is that the investment advisor for the fire pension has changed.
We just recently changed the investment consultant for the fire pension fund to the same one that the police pension fund uses. I had some concerns about the one that we had for the last year and a half, and documented some of the mistakes that he had made during that year and a half, and successfully was able to show that we really probably needed to move on, and the decision was made to move on. And I feel like we're in a much better place. Yeah. I mean, this consultant, I was very happy with them on police. They really thoroughly look at everything and make solid recommendations. They're not, you know, crazy, you know, trying to do crazy things. They're trying to build a put together a good plan of how the assets are allocated and stick to it, and, you know, evaluate all the investment choices that we've made, and are they keeping up with their benchmarks, looking at the benchmark. And so it's really a solid plan, and I think we're going to get there with the fire too.
And they're going to be, and they are also part of this meeting that we have.
Yeah, they'll come to the meeting, and they actually are the ones that determine what the interest rate assumption is. So.
Yeah, and if you look at your financials in general, the one area where we continue to work on is really the public safety pension funding. So, you know, as the auditors have commented on here today, financially we're in very good shape. Our general fund reserves are more than adequate at this point. We look at strategic use of our reserves and our budgeting, but the amount that we're contributing to public safety pensions has risen considerably based on these plans over the last several years. So that's starting and continues to put pressure on the general fund as we look at having to make some changes in personnel and reduce things to civilian positions. Really is twofold: one, to pay for the obligation in today's dollars, but then also try to reduce your obligation in future years. So we'll continue to do that. In addition to the tax levy, the other thing the Finance Committee may have to take up next year, and we'll give you a recommendation on that, is our debt service extension base will be coming up next spring. So as you know, we have a limited bonding authority, debt authority, as a non-home rule community. We did a two-year loan to ourselves essentially last year to maintain that. We'll probably come up with a similar structure again this year, but that'll be coming up on the radar screen as well. And the last, you know, one thing I always like to go back and look at things from a historical perspective, and this is probably, unfortunately, Joan's last review of an audit, that would be my guess, but I really, you know, and I think everyone knows this, but I really can't say enough about the work that Joan has done over the last 7-8 years here, and the shape that we are in on our financials, both as an organization in terms of procedures and policies and manuals and how the department runs on a daily basis, certainly, but then just the sheer positivity that we're seeing in our financial documents and the fact there are no adjusting entries and all these other things is 100% because of Joan's leadership. So I think that should be noted as Joan moves on
She's
to bigger and better, things, right?
I wholeheartedly concur. It's been, you know, just as elected officials, I mean, you know, we just look at everything from the top level, and just to know and have the confidence that we have folks like Eric and Joan and the department heads here that are so professional and so, you know, rooted in doing what's best for the community, and, you know, really stay on top of their best practices, and, you know, they're part of all these other organizations that allow them to learn new and great ways to make our systems and processes better. Just really high integrity people, so we're very lucky to have them. And I'm trying behind the scenes to make sure that this is not her last.
I'm encouraging. I'm trying to encourage her daughter to go to law school because then that
means
you have to keep working.
Just too good to pass up, but you know.
And I wholeheartedly She didn't want
to go to law school. I said, you can go to law school, but it's going to be on your dime. And you need to start working. Maybe you can find an employer that'll pay for that.
Right.
So eventually, another thing we're probably going to have to look at is, you know, candidate.
We're
not rushing you out the door at all, please.
Sure. Just real quick, I know the difference because I used to keep doing that, but I can just, you know, the difference between a quality person in charge of our budget, and I've seen the opposite in an extreme, and it's so great to know that the village is in such good hands now.
Thank you.
It was very difficult at the time to go to see what we had gone through and then to see what we achieved, so
mm-hmm.
that was because of you.
Yeah, a lot of hard work.
And Eric.
Thank
yes.
you.
Well,
Eric
is
a team.
I
know it is a
we
team.
Always say that the village administrator is the most important job.
Yeah, Eric.
I'm the first to admit it.
Right?
No.
But Eric, hired her back, right?
Yeah. No, I
grabbed
we met,
her back.
Was it a St. Charles Panera?
Yeah.
All right. Well, we're not going to get sentimental here.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. What else do we need to do on our agenda? I think we reviewed everything. Any questions? I appreciate you guys taking the time out to come here. This is important to talk about. Next steps will be the draft will be finalized, Joan. Do we have to do a motion?
Yeah,
to,
maybe
recommend the
someone
audit?
Could if okay. someone could make a motion to recommend acceptance of the audit report to the Board of Trustees.
I move to accept the audit report and give it to the Board of Trustees.
I second.
Okay. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Okay. So what is our next meeting?
October 9th.
October 9th.
Yep.
We will have a final version of this. I assume we're going to have the auditors come to the meeting
mm-hmm.
in the event that the board has questions. And at that time, then we'll accept the audit into the record. So any other comments? Cheryl, thank you too for your copious note taking and help at the finance levels.
Yeah, Cheryl does a lot of work on the
so,
audit and all the fixed asset
yes.
reporting and various journal entries, and it's kind of a team effort to
yep.
get ready for the audit. So she's doing a good job this year.
With that, any other questions, any other comments from the auditors? We appreciate your taking the time to come out, and thank you for arranging the meeting, and I will call for a motion to adjourn.
Move.
To adjourn.
Seconded.
So
okay. Seconded by Trustee Conte. Meeting adjourned. Thank you.
Thank you.